You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Aloud. I'm glad you're all here this evening, and I am sort of welcoming in. This is our second show, so welcome to a new season of Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. This season, we'll be focusing on resilience. We choose this for obvious reasons. Each of us have had to grapple with the complications, the challenges, and the changes that the pandemic has presented. And we've all had to find a place, a space within ourselves, a resilience in order to keep our lives moving forward. Tonight's guest, poet, inspirational speaker, and prison abolitionist Yosef Salaam, his life and his work embodies resilience. Before I introduce tonight's guests, I do want to talk briefly about the Library Foundation and its role. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumentally involved in supporting many programs at the Los Angeles Public Library. I mentioned a particular program before when our guest was also someone who had experienced being incarcerated as a teenager. The program that I want to talk about is Teens Leading Change. TLC, which provides teens an avenue to make a difference in their communities. And one of these programs touched on the criminal justice system in a smart and sort of proactive way. One of the groups explored the school's use of discipline and how it can contribute to the school to prison pipeline. Teens in this program reached out to activists, arts educators, civil rights lawyers, and school administrators to learn more. With the information they gathered, they conducted interviews with their teachers and used what they learned to reflect on the educational alternatives. This is where change begins. And it's wonderful that we're doing these programs and that the Library Foundation is supporting them at the public library. So I wanted to impart some of that news and to just say we love your support in these areas. Now let me introduce our exceptional guest this evening. Yosef Salaam is a poet, a writer, an inspirational speaker, a prison abolitionist. At 14, Yosef was one of the five teenage boys wrongly convicted and then sentenced to the Central Park jogger case. In 1997, he left prison as an adult. And in 2002, the sentences for the Central Park Five were overturned, and all five were exonerated for a crime they did not commit. Yosef speaks about the effects of incarceration and its destructive impact. He's an advocate and an educator on issues of mass incarceration, police brutality, misconduct, press ethics and bias, race and law, and the disparities in the criminal justice system, especially for men of color. In Yosef's recent New York Times bestselling memoir, Better Not Bitter, Living on Purpose, in the pursuit of racial justice, he not only touches on his own personal story, but also gives thoughtful and inspiring guidance reflecting on issues that haunt our racially divided country. Tonight, he will be with Echo Yanka, is a professor of law at Cardozo Law School at Yeshiva University in New York City. He sits on the board of the Innocence Project, where he was awarded the Advocate for Justice in 2017. His work focuses on questions of political and criminal theory, and particularly questions of political obligation and justifications of punishment. For years, he served as the co-chair of the New York Democratic Lawyers Council, the voting right arm of the New York Democratic Party, and coordinating arm of the DNC. In 2020, he was awarded the Guardian of Democracy Award by the New York Democratic Lawyers Council. That year, he was appointed the New York's Public Campaign Finance Board, which he now serves as chairman. He writes for a wide group of publications, including the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Salon, and has been a regular commentator on criminal law issues at various outlets, including NBC, CNN, MSNBC, BBC, BBC International, NPR, and PBS. Please welcome Yosef Salaam and Echo Yanka. Thank you both for being here. And I'm really happy to have been able to introduce both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well. Much appreciated. Thank you for having us, Jessica. Thank you for setting this up. Yusuf, it's terrific to see you again. It's been much too long since we've been together in person. How are you?
Oh, man, I so much agree. I am doing well. Glad to be in conversation with you.
Now, you know, usually I'd say, look, I've got two small kids, so, you know, I've just been trying to survive. But you've got a huge family, and in the interim, you cranked out a best-selling book. So the first question is, why are you trying to make the rest of us look so bad?
You know, one of the funny things about my journey, I was speaking with one of the elders once, and they reminded me, they said, you have to ask what's next. What am I supposed to do with this journey that I've been on, right? This journey of life, the dash that is in between your birth and your death. And they reminded me that I knew that I was on assignment, and I needed to be asking, what do I do next with these gifts, right? Having been a survivor of one of the worst kinds of, I call it a crime, right? I call it a crime because when you think about all of the things that happen in the backdrop of the Black experience, these experiences oftentimes are related almost as anomalies, right? The Central Park Jogger case and the Central Park Five and the Yusuf Salams and Raymond Santana, Corey Wises, Antoine McCrae's and Kevin Richardson's of the world, they're almost seen as the exceptions. We got it wrong that time, but we often don't get it wrong. And then you look at the great work that the Innocence Project is doing, freeing people from horrible times that they are doing through DNA, right? Not because of some mistake that has been uncovered, but through deoxyribonucleic acid. And I think it's important that we keep on looking at the sometimes restlessness that we have in our hearts to try to do more. And I think that that's what I've been trying to do. I really haven't been trying to overshine or any of that stuff.
No, you're just doing that by nature. No, but your point is, of course, really well taken. You know, just half a generation ago, a Supreme Court justice wrote that it was unthinkable that anybody innocent was on death row. And now you and I, you know, in the work that we get to do together, know how many people, indeed, worse than that, all we know is how many people have been wrongfully convicted. We don't know how many people we've never gotten to who've been wrongfully convicted or no longer with us, executed by the state. You put it so well. You say, look, people treat it as though the Yusuf Salams and Corey Watt, as though these five young boys are just blips and accidents. But we know from our work that not only does this happen too often, but it doesn't happen randomly. It happens to certain people all the time. It happens to young men of color systematically. And in the life experience of young men of color, this is well known. So I want to go back to that crime. I know that much of the book is wonderfully about your triumph, and those of us who know you aren't surprised by that, but I want to go back to that crime. One of the moments in the book you write about is here this crime happened, right? This young woman is brutally raped in Central Park. That part is not made up. But the police decide to get the usual suspects. And you were such a thoughtful young man. You thought, this isn't right. My name is being brought up. I'm going to go clear this up, right? And you write that when you were on the way to clear this up, your brother, alarm bells are going off in his mind's eye. That is, he knows by experience, by his lived experience, that this is dangerous for you. And he tries to stop you from going to the police to clear your name, as you know, so many Americans are taught. Just go talk to the police, clear it up. So I want to ask you to talk a little bit about that moment, and even in a slightly painful way, we won't only dwell on this. Talk about what your brother knew that you didn't know. What did your brother sense that you didn't?
He sensed the danger, right? My mother had been telling us that she was raised in the Jim Crow South. And I talk about this in my book, of course. But what's interesting about this scenario, this scene that you're painting, is that my brother is my younger brother, and he's sensing danger. I'm so naive at this point, thinking that I can help, thinking that I can say something, not even understanding the first warning of your Miranda rights. Even before you get to Miranda, because I never was read my Miranda warnings, right? They gave me a Miranda card and told me to sign it after everything, after they couldn't get me to make a confession, a false confession, or anything like that. But it's interesting because when you think about the Miranda itself, it tells you you have the right to remain silent. If you fail to heed the first warning, part two kicks in. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Not it might be used against you, not we may consider what you're saying and figure it out. No, we're going to take your words and use it against you in a court of law. And then when we think about the reality in the Black and Brown communities, or even in the margins of life, most people who find themselves confronted with the criminal justice system, they find themselves in a position having to realize that those who lack the capital are the ones oftentimes that go to prison. So in this scenario, I'm still naive. I'm still like, well, I can help. I can, you know, I'll just go to them and let them know what I saw, that I wasn't involved in anything, because I saw some of the things that happened. Those individuals who assaulted people in Central Park, who threw rocks at, you know, the passing vehicles in the park, all of those individuals were picked out of lineups. All of them. They all went to prison for various crimes that they committed. And yet when the people who were assaulted in Central Park, aside from the jogger, when they came to the precinct to identify us in lineups, when they came to the courthouse and were asked on the witness stand under oath, do you see the person or persons who did this to you? Not only did they not pick us out of lineups, they also said it wasn't any of these guys. The system made people believe that we were guilty of something. And the truth of the matter was that we were guilty because of the color of our skin. And that's something that my brother really was already tapping into. He was afraid for me. I was unaware that when I came up to my apartment, after the police had returned to my apartment looking for me, that they were in front of my door trying to convince my brother to go to the precinct with them. And he wasn't even in the park. This was the system that we continue to face. It's not like it's yesterday and everything is greater and better because of it. We've seen when they see us and now we truly understand that we need to really see you. No, they're hoping, unfortunately, that the truths that are uncovered through our stories, our lived experiences, are relegated to it was just them. Mm-hmm. And I want to just bring out a point. When you think about the idea of it was just them, meaning like this is not how we move in the criminal justice system, I want to bring out the fact that, and I'm picking up my first book of that I published with Edie Zaboy. This is Punching the Air. And the reason why I'm picking this out is because on page 276 and 277, I get into the description of this thing called the 13th Amendment. And we say that while we talk, shout, and whisper, Imani writes on her poster board, the 13th Amendment. Then she writes some more words. Dr. Benu nods. Y'all should know this, he said. Y'all really should understand this. The Constitution of the United States of America, 13th Amendment, Section 1. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Now that's bad because we read the word slavery, and this is obviously after slavery was abolished, but allows slavery to continue by another name. But Section 2 is really concerning. Section 2 says Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. When we think about the legislation that comes down, you know, they say blip rolls downhill. I don't curse, but you fill in the blanks. When you think about the legislation, that legislation harms the people at the bottom of life, the people who are struggling to survive, the people who are pushed to the margins of life, not because they want to be there. Nobody wants to be in impoverished communities. Nobody wants to live in dilapidated buildings. But when you think about the construct that we are presented with, and then the idea that they give us a choice. And when I say they give us a choice, you have to understand, in my lived experience, my mother said to me that they needed me to participate, mm-hmm. whatever it was that they were trying to do. She cautioned me and reminded me not to participate, to refuse. And so we look at all of the things that are presented to us. Yesterday, when there was an epidemic of untold proportions, it was a war on drugs that was exacted upon the Black and Brown community. Today, when there's an epidemic of untold proportions, there is an opioid crisis that requires for the Betty Ford Clinics of America to be opened to assist and help people. We needed that.
Yeah.
And we still need that.
Now, look, there's no question. And you write powerfully about the way in which we point the canon of policing at some people, right? But other people, we see social problems, not criminal law problems. Let me take a minute to do what, I'm not a talk show host, but if I was a talk show host, I would have done what you did. Let me take a minute to show people your wonderful book. You are now a New York Times bestseller. I was thrilled for you. I'm thrilled to have a chance to wave it in the air. But I do want to defend 14, 15-year-old Yusuf in one way, which is you speak about how naive you were. But of course, it's true that what we are taught in part is you're supposed to help the police. You're supposed to help your community. You're supposed to, if you know the right, you're willing to say, I didn't do it, let me. And it's a statement about how broken the system is that your brother could sense this kind of what we would say theoretically just ordinary civic virtue is going to be turned against you because the machinery is consuming, right? The machinery just wants to punish you. And one of the places you write about that, again, I hate to go to such a painful moment, but you write, I'm not going to steal your words, but maybe I'll invite you to talk about how a friend of yours came to support you in these worst moments in the police station and how the machinery just tried to consume him as well. And the kind of guilt all of you young men felt that, you know, these young Black men were considered such stray lives, stray souls, shrapnel, that people could just accidentally get swept up in the maw. Could I ask you to say a few words about that moment?
You know, the real problem, if you want to think about it from that perspective. And, you know, when I think about it, I think about, you know, my big brother, when he came to the precinct to help, and he just came as a support because he wasn't coming in his official capacity, right? I didn't know the weight or the weightiness of who he represented and what that meant for me, right? My blood brother, his big brother, was a person who knew a lot about finances. His father was in the legal profession. You know, his mother was, I believe, an architect, I think, or something like that. Whereas my big brother was in the legal profession as well. He was the assistant U.S. district attorney for the Eastern region of the United States. I didn't know that, right? And he was coming there just to support me. Hey, I hear my little brother is here. Can I see him? I want to talk to him. And they asked him, first of all, they moved on him. They knew exactly who he was. As soon as he walked in, they knew who he was. And they moved on him like a machine, asking him, was he here in his official capacity? He said, no, I'm here to see my little brother. I just want to talk to him. I want to find out what happened. And they told him that if he did not leave, they would have his job. I mean, think about that. I want the idea to be that in this Rubik's Cube of trying to figure out what happened, the real perpetrator was out committing more crime. The real perpetrator had a modus operandi that his victims revealed. He would give them a choice. He said to them, your eyes or your life. And if you could not live without your eyes, he would kill you. But at the point where he raped and tried to murder the Central Park jogger, just a few days prior to that, he tried to rape and murder another woman. And she fought him off. The police got it so wrong that in their rush to judge, all of the mistakes that they made allowed for the real criminal to continue to commit more crime. And the worst atrocity happened. A young woman named Lourdes Gonzalez, we should never forget her name. She was a young, pregnant Latina woman. She was a mother. She was a wife. And I'm using the past tense because Matias Reyes came to her home after raping the Central Park jogger, months after raping the Central Park jogger, brandishing a knife. She pleaded with him, "Can I just put my children in the room next door? And he allowed her to do so. This is him. This is his words. He was speaking to, I believe, Cynthia McFadden at the time in a jailhouse interview. And he says, he allowed her to put her children in the room next door. And in my mind, I'm putting myself in her shoes. I'm trying to figure out what is she thinking at this moment. She probably is thinking this is going to be one of the worst experiences that I will ever have in my life, but I'll survive. She comes back and he rapes her. And he doesn't give her a choice. Your eyes or your life. He murders her, stabbing her to death. The proof that this happened is that she's one of the reporters, one of the main news personalities. It's on the tip of my tongue. It's going to come to me. Sure. but she's one of the main news personalities. And she said this happened in her building. Mm. The tenants in the building came out of their homes after they heard her screams, Lourdes Gonzalez's screams, her last screams for life. And they came and they held Matias Reyes until the police came. Mm. Had the system got it right, Lourdes Gonzalez would have been alive today.
No, that's absurd. I mean, the fact that they were more concerned about locking up anybody, that you were, as you put it, that you were treated as disposable. And by the way, you know, I also want to make sure we also say, you know, Trisha Melli, who's the Central Park jogger, because in the same way I have learned from you, the way in which history was quick to consign you as the Central Park Five, so too, that she's been reduced to the Central Park jogger is something that even I, you know, I should remember to do better than, right? She's a young woman who's also let down. It's not to say there weren't mistakes made. I'm not talking about her assault, of course. I'm talking about the prosecution. But it is also true that a system that just is happy to lock up anybody to keep moving, to have Youssef Salaam be fuel rather than the actual criminal, let her down just as well. There's so much to talk about, so many good things to talk about, but one last note on what didn't go well. One of the things you write about is how eager people were to make you and your four brothers the conspirators. How, you know, we know, of course, that now a major ominous looming political figure, which to your credit, you actually spend very little time on him. But it wasn't just our former president who spent his own money to advocate for the death sentence. It was also newspaper personalities and radio. And people were, as people say more casually, people were making their money on feeding the crowd, feeding the maw. One of the nice lines you write, a beautiful line, is that the media screamed about your guilt, but whispered about your innocence. And I wonder if you could reflect on that for a moment.
I mean, you got to remember, those of us who were in New York at the time, they remember it so vividly that there were our story was in the news on the front page for months. Within the first few weeks of this case, there were over 400 articles written about us. I direct people to a really powerful book that captures this madness called Savage Portrayals by Natalie Byfield. And what was going on was a broad brush stroking of convincing the public that we had to be guilty of something. I remember when things came out like DNA evidence, it was in big, bold headline prints. And what that signifies when a person is looking at something, it imprints on their minds something that the system wants you to see. It's similar to the study that was done, not the same, but similar, you'll see why I'm saying this, to the study that was done. And they found out that they I think it was like a I don't want to throw any company under the bus, but I'm just going to choose a name just for namesake purposes only. Hopefully this is not the company that may have participated in this kind of this act, right? In the movie industry, people used to be watching films, and unbeknownst to them, something was presented in front of their eyes that they could not see because it was mm-hmm. just a split second. Mm-hmm. And it caused people to get up and say, oh, I don't know why I'm so thirsty. Let me go get me a Coca-Cola, or let mm-hmm. me go get me a IC, or whatever it was that was presented to you. Mm-hmm. And when you slow motion picture down and you found out that this was what was happening, it was a brainwashing and a conditioning so that people would purchase a product and not purchase another. This is something that I studied when I came out of prison. I was so shocked to hear about something like this. But then you think about that in the context of the Central Park Jogger trial. When the big bold headlines came out, DNA evidence, and they tested our DNA. Mind you, Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson were arrested April 19th, 1989, the same day that Patricia Mealy was assaulted and left for dead in Central Park. They had not a drop of blood on them. Mm-hmm. Patricia Mealy lost 3/4 of her blood. Mm-hmm. The system was convinced that we had done it. You know, and then when we found out that our DNA didn't match, it was in smaller headlines. Mm-hmm. It might have not even been seen by most of the people, mm-hmm. but the negative residue of those larger headlines stayed in the people's minds, which is why Donald Trump, so many years later, when he was asked about the Central Park Five, as we were known back then, he said, well, they had to be guilty of something.
Well, that I just want to pick up on those words, because when you write about the disposability of Black men, I think that's a really powerful idea. That part of what people think, I mean, I think part of what makes it possible to sleep at night when you consider just the consuming nature of our criminal justice system is this kind of idea people are fed. Well, maybe they didn't get exactly the right charge, but those guys are guilty of something. And that something is just, as you say, you know, and this is, stamped from the beginning, the wonderful book that won countless awards, makes this point even more powerfully. If you are born with the presumption that something you did is guilty, then I can sleep because I don't have to be, you know, I mean, of course I want the system to get it kind of right, but look, he's guilty of something. And I think that intuition drives an incredible amount of willful ignorance about our system, about what you call $1 trillion. How did you put it? It's such a lovely phrase. Ignorance is $1 trillion industry.
Yeah, ignorance is $1 trillion industry. You know, I want to read something to you. One of my great attorneys, late great attorneys, was Bill Kunstler. And I remember I was a part of a film that the Kunstler daughters created for their dad called William Kunstler Disturbing the Universe.
I know it well, sure.
Oh my goodness, I love that film, because what happened in that film too was that as they were trying to memorialize their father, this great figure in civil rights, you know, justice, all of that, they were finding out that I was actually innocent of this crime. They were finding out that their father was fighting the good fight. But what I want to draw people to this, to in particular, to what he said on May 13th of 1995 when he was at SUNY Buffalo. He said, anytime you're faced with injustice and you're in a position to do something, you have to do something. Mm-hmm. And that's the terrible myth of organized society, that everything that is done through the established system is legal. And that word has a powerful psychological impact. It makes people believe that there is an order to life and an order to a system. And that person that goes through this order and is convicted has gotten all that is due him. And therefore, society can turn off its consciousness and look to other things and other times. He goes on to say, and that's the terrible myth about these past trials. They have this aura of legitimacy, this aura of legality. I suspect that better men than the world has known and more of them have gone to their deaths through a legal system than through all the illegalities in the history of man. 6 million people in Europe during the Third Reich, legal. Sacco Vanzetti, quite legal. The Haymarket defendants, legal. The hundreds of rape trials throughout the South where Black men were condemned to death, all legal. Jesus, legal. Socrates, legal. And then he ends by saying, and that's the kaleidoscope, that's the kaleidoscopic nature of what we live through here and in other places, because all tyrants learn that it is far better to do this thing through some semblance of legality than to do it without that pretense.
You know, one of the cases I start my criminal law class with is the Scottsboro Boys, which we now learn in American history, when people learn in American history, as a veneer of a lynching. But of course, one of the things that really people forget that after the Scottsboro Boys were condemned of a clearly false rape, a story that echoes across time into your life, that Southern newspapers took out ads saying, what more did you want? You complained when we lynched them. Here we tried them. I.e. the aura of legality was precisely the thing people were selling. But you know, listen, I don't want to just focus on this, because one of the things that I read over and over when not just reading your book, but reading about your book, was the constant refrain that the book is full of such warmth and generosity and optimism. And of course, those of us who know you weren't surprised by this at all. You yourself are full of warmth and generosity and optimism. So I know it's a bit of a line right down Broadway. But I do think people want to hear how it is you're writing about your deep spiritual, your deep faith, your growth in faith while you're in prison, your deep love for your mother, which you've already referenced, the people in your life who supported you, how it is that you kept this core, not just of the person who became successful, but of the optimistic person who became successful.
You know, I think in large part, that was because of my grandmother. That was because of the people who prayed for me. That was because of the visits that my mother made often. I mean, it was the light at the end of the tunnel that I kept my eyes on. We know that there's a statement, keep your eyes on the prize, and that was the prize. It was the choice that I had to make to either let the time do me or for me to do the time. And if I did the time, then I needed to bend the time. I needed to manipulate the time. I needed to turn the time into something useful so that I didn't succumb to the vicious trap that we hear about often. It was the understanding of what Malcolm X talked about when he said that the people who got educated, they stopped that revolving door of recidivism. Mm-hmm. Why did that door continue in the first place? It continued because quite often in the Black and Brown communities, we're fed a lie. And the lie that we're fed and we believe is that we're gonna be dead or in jail before we reach the age of 21. And so in communities that have been overrun with poverty, overrun with crime, overrun with all kinds of atrocities, it is a celebratory moment that they celebrate all the time, unfortunately. And oftentimes that celebration comes with recklessness. It is the understanding that you only live once, coined with the term YOLO, but it is the what is behind the idea of YOLO in the young person's mind. Because you only live once, and because this is a damned life that we live, we need to spend all the money we get, not saving a dime. We need to break all of the things that we can get our hands on, not concerned with our health. Do all kinds of things, live it up, because no one's promised tomorrow. And the truth of the matter is that I talk about this in my book, and I was reminded of it from my good friend and mentor, Les Brown, that every single one of us were born on purpose. And like Dr. King said in his great speech, that when you find your purpose in life, do it as if God himself called you to do it at this very moment. And instead of giving us grand ideas of what purpose could be, he went all the way down the ladder to perhaps one of the most menial jobs, saying that if your purpose in life is to be a street sweeper, sweep the streets like Michelangelo painted pictures, like Leotard Price sang before the opera, like Beethoven composed music. Be excellent, he was urging us. Because those of us who succumb to a value system, an idea that is planted in our communities that we did not plant in our own selves, we then begin to move throughout our lives as if we are mistakes. And if we just, if we oppose, and by opposing, I'm talking about take a 50,000 foot view of your life. Call the law of attraction into it by imagining a life of success and marrying that vision, because they say, if you can't see it, you can't achieve it. Marry that vision with what you believe the feeling would be to have success. No one coming knocking on your door telling you that your home is being foreclosed or your home is being taken because it was gotten by ill gains. No one coming and dragging you, your wife, and children out of a vehicle that was gotten by ill gains. There's a certain happiness and strength and pride that you get from putting all of the pieces of the puzzle together correctly. Even if you started on the wrong foot, you always get the opportunity to change. That's what Malcolm X was talking about when he said those individuals who were getting educated never came back through the revolving door of recidivism.
That's how Detroit Red became Malcolm X, right?
Yeah, he found out he had more options than one.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I also think we shouldn't forget part of what matters, and you touch upon this in different places of the book, is whether or not you live in a world where your good actions are rewarded, right? I think one of the reasons, you put it so well, one of the reasons some people live like there's nothing more to tomorrow is they've seen their hopes come to nothing for reasons outside of themselves, right? So if you did all the right things for a while and then something just comes and, you know, somebody arrests you for no reason and then you lose the job, and that kind of frustration embitters a man and embitters a woman. It embitters people quickly. If you live in a community where you look around and your cousin did everything right and it was still dashed, or your older brother got swept up because he went to, you know, play with friends in Central Park one day, it makes it harder for you to have faith. And so you talk about, you're not shy in pointing out that it's not just an injustice about your life. It's the way the structure refuses to reward people of color. And you're also not shy about saying that means some folks of color make really bad choices, but it's in the background of their lives looking like you're the fool, you're the sucker if you play by the rules, because, you know, it's not like the kid down the street who plays by the rules and the rewards are there, right? It's, you know, it's easily snapped away from you.
You know, that's so true. And it's alluring, right? I think about the culture, right? The culture called hip hop, as an example. The hip hop culture probably is 100% weaponized at this point. This same culture that used to have music in the messages that was being revealed and messages in the music, this same culture that was the continuation of the griot or the jelly of Africa, talking about the history and very important things that needed to be reminded us, we needed to be reminded of. And so it was in this poetic format that it was being revealed and shared. It is that same thing that we have to fight against. Because see, the thing about it is this. When we get lemons in life, there are those of us who choose to curse God out and say, why do I have lemons? And there are others of us who choose to figure out how to make lemonade. And the truth of the matter is that once you find your secret power that we all have, that you were born on purpose and with a purpose, nothing that is for you will ever be denied you. Oftentimes, we get trapped in an emotional state.
Actually, can I pick up on that? Because you write beautifully about your faith that everything that happened to you happened for a reason. You actually at one point call the Central Park case a beautiful play, a covenant between God, you, and your people. Could I focus you on that? Yeah.
Absolutely. Because when I look about the case, right, I look at it and I say to myself, great figures in our communities today, like E.T., we've heard him say things like, everybody wants to be a diamond, but no one remembers that a diamond has tremendous pressure placed upon them. And then more pressure added to that, and then even more pressure still. And then they got to be cut. Nobody wants to be cut. When I think about the Central Park jogger case, it to me becomes this love story of between God and his people. It becomes a love story because of the fact that we survived and we have our faculties and we can now tell the story from the inside out, as opposed to trying to hypothesize about what it's like to shut down a place like Rikers Island. We know why Rikers Island should be shut down. We know why prisoners should be treated humanely and that why they should be given the opportunity to be able to pay for crimes if they have committed crimes and then be returned back to society whole people, not having been double prosecuted and triple prosecuted and living a life where they have now a social death, right? The Central Park jogger case is an example of that. It's an example of the grace that is afforded to a people, right? That it is a love story between God and his people. It's a story also that if you look at us, you realize that we were buried alive and forgotten. And the system forgot we were seeds. And instead of a social death, we were able to emerge like the phoenix from the ashes, because as they tried to build the fire to consume us, they forgot the owner of the heat. That's so dumb.
That's beautiful. You said, I want to say I'm actually a bad person to defend hip hop, because to be honest, I'm kind of a dull middle-aged guy who likes jazz. I mean, I do think that I'm sure there's great hip hop out there. Occasionally my friends play great hip hop for me, but I'm not. But what I do want to say about the hip hop point, because it touches on so much in the book, you know, even the worst hip hop, which frankly, I don't like, you know, I'm like, whatever, let it, I mean, not the most vile of it, but let it play. Because you know what the worst hip hop is like? It's precisely your point about YOLO. You know, I'm one of my other shallownesses is I'm really excited for the new James Bond movie that's coming out. I'm one of those guys. if you're free, let me know. We'll get a babysitter for all our kids and you and I will go check it out. But you know the thing that's great about Bond? It's beautiful. It can be slick. It can be stylish. It can be adventurous. But it's a fantasy, right? None of us think Bond is real. I mean, like you said about YOLO, you're supposed to, you know, Bond lives for today because he might be killed tomorrow. And that can be, your word is so on point, seductive.
Yeah.
But I watch Bond and then I leave it in the theater, right? You know, I've got kids to raise. I've got to save for their college. It's when we are, as a community, denied a vision of the future, just as you say, that the fantasy becomes too seductive, right? I mean, it's fine to watch the hip hop video and leave it where it's supposed to be. It's a fun fantasy. It's not the life you're building. And you actually went out and built that life. So I want to talk about one last thing because we're running out of time. I had so many things to ask you, but I want to have a little bit of a personal confession between you and I. So one of the things that struck me when I met you now many years ago, you know, you and I are almost exactly the same age. And I just always thought, man, this guy and I were supposed to be classmates in law school together, right? Like really, when I hang out with you and we talk, I just think it reminds me of so many conversations I've had. You and I could have been classmates together in law. You and I could be chopping it up, talking about, you know, whether you made partner or not, whether I got tenure or not, a few years ago, luckily that's behind me. Now, I want to be careful how I say this, because at this point, you're an activist, you're a motivational speaker, you've got the beautiful family, you're now a New York Times bestseller. So making you into my classmate might be a demotion at this point in your life. I get that. But I want to ask you just a personal confession. If this hadn't landed on you, you've managed to make this a beautiful, triumphant thing, but what was the other life Yusuf Salam was going to lead? Were you going to be in class with me? Were you in a universe just beside ours? What would you be doing, do you think?
So if I was able to dream.
Everyone should know I did not warn Lisa that this was coming. So.
You know, if I was able to dream that impossible dream,
yeah.
I think about the things that I wanted to do that I never got an opportunity to do.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that I wanted to do that I have gotten an opportunity to do. Like, I wanted to be a jeweler, and I now create jewelry for myself. Have not yet put anything out there for the world to consume, but I'm an artist. I used to go to LaGuardia High School for Music and Art as a graphic designer. Mm-hmm. To be able to use that skill just as a labor of love is a really powerful thing. But I wanted to be an architect. Mm. I loved looking at, I mean, you got to remember, I came from the beginning. People would often argue whether it's really the beginning or not, but the beginning of Harlem, 110th Street, Fifth Avenue. Mm. Fifth Avenue represented wealth and grandeur and all of these nice things, but not my Fifth Avenue. My Fifth Avenue was an erect project building. Mm-hmm. Same conditions that you found yourself in the King Towers and, you know, all the places right there next door was inside of Schomburg Plaza. They just changed the name recently, so it's no longer that, but it's the heritage, right? And it gives people this idea that there's this beauty there. And it is a beautiful thing. What's happening around Central Park, even in the margins of life, is beautiful, but we wanted that. Mm. We wanted that. I loved going.
You mean the structural beauty and the buildings and because of course there are moments in Harlem that are architecturally breathtaking, right?
Oh, but in those, even in those pieces, right, the people who are able to really appreciate that are, one, the people who used to live there are still or they still live there, or the people who are now able to afford to live there now. The individuals who never lived in those beautiful brownstones, as an example, they never knew. Mm-hmm. Right now, and this was years ago, I remember my mother was saying to me when I first came home from prison that they were selling the shells of a lot of the brownstones for $50,000. Mm-hmm. You can't find a shell of a brownstone for $50,000. It would be probably $1 million.
I wish I would have bought one when I was in law school. I didn't have the money.
Listen, but see, that's the thing. When I went from 110th Street, Fifth Avenue to Lincoln Center, I came out of the train station overawed by all of the beauty that I saw. Mm. I was around downtown. I was a student at the Art Students League of New York. And I was walking around and I would often just look up at these buildings. I did the same thing when I came home from prison, being amazed at the structure, at the beauty that I was seeing. And that's something that I would always think about and say, man, had this not happened to me. But the good thing is that I get the opportunity now to play on the other side.
Yeah.
I get the opportunity to be a person who has a seat at the table, right? Mm. Because quite oftentimes when we think about conversation that is being held in the streets today, conversation like defunding the police and, you know, abolition of the prisons and things like that, there's also the other side. There's the side that says, well, what about the real criminals? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, when we think about like white collar crime, things like what Madoff did as an example, well, we want people like that to be taken out of the society, right? We want them to pay for their crimes.
Oh, sure.
And so what we're looking at is the equity
Of course.
Right. We're looking at the, and you know, the worst thing I think about, and Bob Marley said this, Bob Marley was my hero, by the way. Bob Marley said the universities are graduating thieves and murderers. So who's the real criminal?
Yeah.
Other than the people who are creating the construct for you to live in and try to survive in.
Look, I mean, I think you've put it so well. Look, it gets tiresome to hear people say, oh, you know, these people don't want criminals. As you say, somebody who commits a murder or robs, you know, robs one person on the street or robs thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, even for the worst reason. I mean, they're already fabulously rich, but they want yet still more. Those people need to be punished. And nobody denies that. And it is a common and frankly dull trope that Black people only care about criminality when it's a police officer or something like that. These people spend no time in the Black community. You and I know every Sunday, folks are in church meetings and community groups talking about how are we going to save our neighborhoods and make them stronger. And I shouldn't always say save, because sometimes it's make them stronger. Nobody's more obsessed with, you know, Black crime than Black people. But we can keep in mind at the same time that we want equity and that we want the same access to solutions other communities have gotten.
Right.
But the other thing I want to say really quickly is I'm so thrilled to hear about young Yousef the architect, because I just don't like the idea. It ties into two things you said. Kunstler's quote, better men have been thrown away in the prisons than we think. And it is not who you are to reduce you to this horrible moment, even though you've made so much of it, right? Part of what makes people think of young Black men as disposable is they don't think of the Yousef Salaam who would have been a sensational architect or helped rebuild their neighborhood. I mean, that was a real young man with real dreams ahead of him too. And I don't want that to ever get lost in your amazing story, even as it is. Yeah. Listen, I've taken up too much time. There are a bunch of folks who have questions for you. Let me fire off a question for you. Joy asks, were the prosecutors and police involved ever punished? This is a question you and I know. I appreciate this program that shows triumph out of tragedy. So that's our compliment to you. But the question is, what happened to those who were so quick to jump to your conviction and so slow to seek justice?
They were promoted. They built their careers off of our backs. You got to remember that the officers that were interrogating the Central Park Five, as we were once known, were seasoned professionals. You could not get into this elite group of officers unless you had at least 20 years on the job. I'm talking about Manhattan North Homicide Squad. These individuals were the individuals that were called in to interrogate because they thought that she was going to lose her life. And so that's the other part, right? They were able to retire with their full pensions. You think about the prosecutors and the assistant prosecutors and all of that, like Linda Fairstein went on to become a multi-million dollar best-selling author. Elizabeth Lederer, she just recently, what I hear, she was demoted, but she had went on to teach law at Columbia Law School.
At my alma mater, and demoted only after, we've talked about two great projects she did, Ava DuVernay's 13th, which speaks about the hole in the 13th Amendment, which allows prison labor and how that's become an industry unto itself that needs bodies, in particular Black bodies, to keep running. And of course, she did the beautiful rendition of Your Life along with your four brothers called When They See Us, the Netflix series. Only when They See Us came out did some people face social consequences. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go on.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the most powerful things. I think one of the things that we knew that we needed as a group, and by group, I'm talking about the Sacred Brotherhood that was born and rebranded after When They See Us. We knew we needed that infusion of young people to portray us, because when people see me today, there's this disconnect, I would say. They say to themselves, this guy didn't go to prison.
Mm.
I mean, they see me sometimes and they say, oh, he's one of the attorneys.
Yes. I'm telling you, you were supposed to be my classmate. I'm telling you.
I tell you, listen, it's such an interesting thing, because when they saw the new life being pumped into our story, people are still talking about when they see us around the globe. It rippled around the globe at astronomical speeds. Yeah. Over 190 plus countries, not people, 190 plus countries got to see When They See Us when it was released on Netflix.
Yeah.
And not everybody saw it. And people are still seeing it. People are reading about us through Punching the Air and now through Better Not Bitter. Punching the Air has been translated into French and also Portuguese.
Congratulations.
It is getting so much, thank you. It's getting so much energy. And I mean, it's because of what's happening in the world. There's this reckoning that we feel is right. We're right on the cusp of it.
Yeah.
But every time we get two steps forward, we're playing this weird tango where it's 15 steps back.
Such as the, listen, let me let Sarah get in. Sarah asked a really important question. It's been asked before, but can't stop asking it. What do you think is the biggest thing white people can do to stand against injustice and the carceral state that disproportionately affects Black Americans?
I think that there are often white allies. I know them. I'm friends with many of them that don't have the power to change anything. We need that change to come from the top down. Imagine my surprise when I heard about the Stand Your Ground laws. I couldn't believe, I was like, no, this can't be real. This can't be true. You mean to tell me you have a whole conversation about a man who is supposed to stop following another young man who the president at the time said he would look like my son? And yet we found out how that turned out. Still a tragedy, still a tragedy. I think that when we think about the allyship, we're talking really about changing laws. It's important for us to realize that even though we know that this system is not broken, that it's actually working exactly as it was imagined in the minds of the people. And if you don't believe me, all you have to do is go back to the Constitution and read the first line. The first line says, "We the people." And I want you to just pause at that moment and just do a history lesson.
Yeah.
And in the lesson, you realize that Black and brown bodies were not considered whole human beings. We were considered 3/5 of a person. And for all intents and purposes, I believe that that same untruth is still following us today. And so what we need are people who, like the young girl in the audience in California, we were speaking at, I think, UCLA, and she stood up in the audience. She said, "I'm a 13-year-old cadet. I want to become a cop. What advice can you give me?" And instead of me telling her that I wanted her to go into a different profession, I was blessed to understand that I was talking to the future. That imagine her being one of the most special police officers, finding out, like Dr. King said, this is her purpose in life, that on the side of cop cars, we see the words to serve and protect, and she is going to embody this. That on the side of the cars in New York City, the cop cars in New York City, we see the words attitude to serve and protect. We see the words courtesy, professionalism, and respect. What we need is a system with a people who have the power, that like defunding means to me, we allocate funds to allow for the people who are mostly concerned but have the solutions to be funded so that they can do the work, because many of them are operating on a bootstring, on their bootstraps, on the bootstring, what do they call it? The
Shoestrings, I think.
Shoestring. That's what I'm saying.
There you go.
I'm thinking about Dr. King. I'm thinking about Dr. King said, they tell us to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. But that's cruel to tell a bootless man.
Yeah, beautiful. So Yusuf, I was really interested in what the alternative Yusuf would have been doing. Phil wants to know, because obviously the Yusuf that's in front of us is plenty impressive. Phil wants to know, never mind the alternative, Youssef. What's next for you? What's next for this, Youssef?
So what's next for me, I believe, is there is no glass ceiling. The sky is the limit. I see myself perhaps looking at participating in changing some laws, and there's a path to that. I'm putting that process together with my team, and you know, we're figuring out some next steps. But I believe that part of the next steps is planting these seeds in people's hearts and minds, letting people know, like that young girl in that audience who was a 13-year-old cadet at the time, who probably is a police officer today, hopefully she gets an opportunity to hear some of my messages or read some of my books. But if she does, then I'm probably excited to know that she is one of the great officers, that the bad policing that we've all seen, the bad experiences that we've all seen, really represents just a stain on a whole stage of life. But because that stain is there, it keeps getting the attention. We need people who are truly supposed to be in the positions that they are in to take it as if it was part of their church service. No longer should there be a separation of church and state. People shouldn't just say, this is just my job, and when I get to the confessional, I'll be able to pray it away. Marry church and state back together. Allow the goodness that is inside of us to stamp out all of the evil, because greed has been made aware in people's minds. And when we think about all of the things that any faith tells you to stay away from, greed, envy, sloth, the whole nine yards. Imagine we try to really become good people. And so what's next for me is to make sure that I keep my eyes on the prize, that I try to ensure that the opportunities that are presented in front of me get vetted in a way that is meaningful and powerful so that I can participate at the highest levels. Because I think that when I think about the story of Yusuf in the Quran or Joseph in the Bible, it is almost prophetic when I think about it, that here I went through almost the same thing, going to prison for a crime I didn't commit, spending 7 years in prison for that crime I didn't commit, coming out of prison a whole human being. But when we read the story of Joseph and Yusuf, peace be upon him, we realize that God made him have 1,000 times more than was taken from him.
Well, let me say, if I couldn't have you as my classmate, having the opportunity to sit down in conversation with you, your reminder to people that, you know, we talk about jobs, we call them a vocation, and that means calling, right? We're called to these things. We're called to do them well. I know there's nothing but great things ahead for you, but if I have one shot at a different future for me, it's my turn now to try to be a talk show host and say, remind everybody that this New York Times bestselling author, his wonderful book, Better Not Bitter, is currently available. It is as thoughtful as this conversation, frankly, more so because it's just him and not me. I cannot recommend the time and the energy. Buy the book. Yusuf won't say this. That's not his vocation, but the book is worth your time and attention. And that gives me the last chance to also thank Jessica for bringing this conversation together. We are so grateful that I'm grateful I had an opportunity to be in conversation with him. And I'm grateful to you for all the great work you've done over the years. We've met at such great events, always generated by you. So thank you.
Well, thank you. This was such a beautiful, important conversation. And to have you both here is personally means an enormous amount to me. And also for the Library Foundation, I'm very, very grateful to both of you. So thank you. Thank you both so much for being here. And thank you all for watching this evening. It was a terrific conversation. And please come back and see our next Aloud in the next 2 weeks with Ruth Ozeki. Thank you so much. Take care, both of you, and good night.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.